So for the final part of the interview, I just wanted to transition into your life after Dartmouth. So if you could just tell me a little bit about what you did immediately after graduating.
Well, I applied to doctoral programs in economics, and I ended up going to the University of Michigan because I don't know if you're aware, University of Michigan has been sort of at the forefront in terms of diversity. So I got a full ride there, and it was quite a shock. I mean, it was a big culture shock to, because the U University of Michigan is a huge school, and the economics is a very, very small department. And I started the summer after graduation, which was a mistake. I should have taken the summer off. So I went up there, and then I was immediately disappointed. I didn't like the school. I didn't like the size of the school. It was overwhelming. I didn't know anybody up there. It's things like you feel it because one, just the campus and the thousands upon students that are there. And then even though we had, it was a very small department, you had to register with everybody else. So you're standing in this huge space with thousands and thousands of people trying to register for classes, and it was just overwhelming. Didn't particularly like the department, very staid. And the other shock was, okay, actually, you should think that it's going to be more like 5 years to get your doctorate, because the right doing your thesis and getting approved and going through that whole process is very laborious and it takes a long time. So it's not unusual for it to take 5 years. And I was like, what? And then my idea was that I wanted to be an economist for a bank. And when I really looked into it, I found out that you didn't get that. Usually it was white guys who had been, when you would work for about 2 decades as a professor and gained a reputation, then you might get hired as a economist for a bank. But those positions were few and far between, unlike, in subsequent years where, there were more jobs like that in banking. So I thought, and so most of the jobs that were available were to teach, like assistant professors, yada yada. I was like, God, I don't want to be a college professor. So that was surprising. Goal of being an economist for a bank.
I'm so sorry, Vicky. Could
Because I'd
you,
never.
Vicky?
Yes.
Could you repeat what you said after I don't want to be a college professor?
Well, that was pretty much it. I just knew going in that I didn't want to teach, and I had never really thought about that. I thought that, and I don't remember where I got that idea from, but that was my idea. That was my goal. And the fact that it was going to be a long-term goal instead of a short-term goal, I didn't want to do. I didn't. So, what I decided to do was I thought, geez, I really need to hone in on what it is that I can do because the career path that's going to be mapped out for me is not one that I want. My goal, my dream job, if you will, is it's going to be, many, many, many years out. And I didn't think I had the patience to teach. So I thought, okay, I need to leave, go and work, and decide what I want to do. And so I went to the school and said, talked to the dean, and I said, I want to take a leave for a year, find out, what it is I really want to do and how can I approach this and yada yada yada. And then returned. And I said, fine. I had my boyfriend at the time was a Dartmouth grad, was a Dartmouth, I met at Dartmouth, and he was in Chicago in med school. So I said, you know, that's a quick transition, that's close. So I'll move to Chicago and get a job and, you know, kind of fill this out. So I did that. And then I decided, well, what was really going to get me where I wanted to go was to get an MBA. So I went back to the University of Chicago and got my MBA with a concentration in marketing. And my career has been in that, was in that, that field. So I worked for a number of Fortune 500 companies, a large consulting company, Booz Allen and Hamilton. After I worked for them, I wanted to be on the corporate side rather than on the consulting side. So I moved into a corporate environment and had a really good career after that.
Would you say that Dartmouth prepared you to work in corporate, and like in what ways?
Well, I think my whole life prepared me. I think that it was kind of destiny that the powers that be prepared me. And I think that was the whole journey, the transition from, you know, to, you know, an all white school. And dealing with that environment, then going on to Dartmouth, where I was in an environment just like I was going to have in corporate America, surrounded by white men, because I was at the, again, the forefront of women, that were doing, going after careers, and not the, you know, married mommy track. And that's when companies were starting to open up to women and open up to Black women. So for most of my career, I've been the first woman, the first Black woman, the first Black person in any job I've ever had. So, you know, I just said, well, I hope my performance makes it easier for the people of color coming after me, and particularly women of color, because I was always out there on the ledge by myself.
Did you feel isolated working?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. You know, this stuff doesn't get to me. Again, I think my upbringing and what I experienced growing up, the level of confidence that I had, I always knew I am a very smart person. I'm a brilliant strategist. I'm a brilliant marketer. And I had the experience to back it up. So anything anybody thought about me that was less than that, I didn't, you know, consider, but I knew that I was breaking barriers for a lot of the white people I worked with. It was the first time they ever worked with and knew a Black person. So, you know, it was what it was, but no, it didn't stress me out or work. You know, I see the opportunities that women have now, which were not open to me. And I sort of said, gosh, I wish I had been able to do this, that, and the other. But I remember my mother saying that as well. I don't think that my mother would have taught school. She wanted to go to law school. But, you know, that was just not a career track for many Black women. One of her best friends actually was the person that brought a lawsuit against the University of Georgia because they would not accept him into the law school because he was black. And he ended up going to Northwestern law school. But, a black man, had a lot of problems. It was just not a track open to my mom at the time. And that's gonna be the way it is for a long time, for a lot of generations. You like blacks and technology, that's been a very hard field for large numbers of blacks to get into. I remember I actually got invited to do an interview at Apple back in the day. And if they had hired me, I'd be a very wealthy woman by now. Because that was at the they had just became, leading tech company. So it was in the beginning in the heyday of Apple. I, they showed me around, they call it a campus. I did not see one black person at Apple. And I knew that they were not going to hire me. But you go through all these things. I had this guy, I don't remember what company it was, but I was back on the East Coast, and this guy flew me out. And I don't remember if it was Chicago or somewhere. And then it was Midwest. And he said, oh, now, I would probably sue them. But he said, I just wanted to meet you because when I saw your resume and you're a black woman that went to an Ivy League school, I just wanted to meet you. Now, nobody would now would they be wise not to say that? They've been well versed by HR to say something like that. But I was like, are you kidding me? And then I had another investment company do the same thing. Because I had written them a letter. They had done something that I was very impressed by. And I just sent them a letter, talking about whatever. And then they invited me to come up for an interview. And then they too said, oh, well, we really don't have anything. Now, maybe both were lying and they just, but they had me believe that they were interviewing me for a job. They wanted to interview me for a job. So it's like stuff like that, People want to meet you because you're like a unicorn. You're black, you're a woman, and you went to an Ivy League school. You went to one of the top five business schools in the country. Wow. Yeah, it was like, the monkey in the zoo. Let's go see the monkey in the zoo type of thing. But that's, I just said, it was their loss, not my loss. Although I really wish I had that Apple stock. But no, you're always in the vanguard, and somebody's always, breaking barriers and, and I like to think that the seven of us said, hey, black women can come and thrive at Dartmouth. And so we don't have to be concerned about, can they make us? And I say we were a sure thing because not only did they have our first term grades, by the time they had admitted us, we had probably gone through midterms. So they knew, academically that we could do the work. Unlike, taking in freshmen, you think they can do the work, but you don't know until they actually, take the classes and get the grades. So they knew that we were academically strong. So it wasn't that much of a risk, right? Like,
They also knew you were socially plugged in as well.
But again, those are all things that you accept as you know that you are the first anything. And again, because I knew I was, shall we say, inference, good enough and strong enough, and prepared enough that I could do it. I've had three VPs that I had worked with, who all said the same thing. You are one of the smartest people I've ever worked with. And I knew it. Well, not that they, had ever worked with, but that I was that good. In fact, when I worked at one company for a senior VP, and he reported into the CEO, and the CEO had to review his okay, I'm drawing a blank, but your how you did, right? And so he wrote up my review, and he told me, the guy said, nobody can be this good. Go back and rewrite it. Find something. So he said, I just want to tell you the stuff that I had to put in there that were very minor things, but he would just not let me give you like a wonderful 100% glowing review. He said, nobody could be that good.
I'm thinking you must have retired by now.
Oh yeah. I got I was, sometimes breaking barriers is tiresome. And sometimes you just say enough is enough. And I was ready to go.
Did you retire early or?
I would have worked longer had I been happier with the trajectory of where I was going. But certain things just, I mean, I was privy because of my level to be aware of certain things. And where I was, I just didn't want to deal with it anymore.
Do you feel like you were sort of prevented from like going to the highest position because of your identity?
Yeah.
You were put in
It's
a box.
yeah, it's hard work. Like, well, I won't say that. It might sound racist. But sometimes men can rise to high levels, even if they're incompetent. I would not have, the saying about being 10 times better just to be, considered average, that you have to be brilliant from the get-go. Where there can be no denying that you're, pretty good. I'll give you an example. I was asked to attend a meeting, and I don't remember the exact, but with a group of board members of the company. And we went through some exercises. I don't remember what it was, but we went through some exercises with them doing something. And then we were each asked to present our idea or concept or something. And I was one of the, in terms of level, junior members, if you will. And I was on this team who had two people that were considerably higher than two women, as it turned out, that were higher than me. So they said, okay, well, who wants to present from this group? Well, you know, these two women just sat there because I was expecting, you know, okay, you're at, you know, this very high senior level, and, you know, I'm expecting them to say, you know, I'll present. They sat there and I said, okay. So I finally spoke up and said, because there were only three of us and they weren't volunteering. So that kind of, you know, by default left me, and I was expecting them. And I said, I'll do it. And then I said, and, you know, I'd like for whoever to do it with me. So I got up there, you know, and presented. And I was like, I can't believe that, you know, they wouldn't volunteer. I mean, that just astounded me. So anyway, I happened to be sitting ne next to one of the board members, and we started talking. And he said, I hope that I get to meet with you again. You're in one of our meetings, or something to that effect. So I had impressed him, a board member of a major Fortune 500 company. I had impressed him enough that he thought I deserved to be in meetings with the board. But that was an outside perspective, right? Whereas inside, you know, it can be a lot of other things that, you know, and I, you know, we used to have what we call people meetings. And that's when, you know, you come together as the department, all the senior members, and talk about the folks that worked in the department and their review and their performance, and, you know, what were your impressions of them, yada, yada, yada. So we talk about everybody, not just our direct reports. And I saw how some people that I would not have said were racist would talk about people of color. And, you know, it's just like behind closed doors, you know, things get said. You know, and you can say, oh, that's my opinion, that's my assessment, and you think that is tinged with more than a little racism. You know, if this person had been white, you would not be saying this. This is a really gifted person. And that's one of the reasons, actually, to come full circle, how I started interviewing and writing up the recommendations, or the, I don't know what they call it now, don't forget. But when I worked in
Recommendations.
Gillette, and there was a white guy that worked in Gillette, at Gillette, and somehow they put us in contact, and we said, okay, we'll do the interviews together. And I've always said I really want to interview particularly Black applicants and students of color. So we were interviewing. And we had interviewed this great young Black guy. And so we talked about his review. This guy had like a total different impression of this young man than I did. So I was just astounded. Now, not using, you know, any type of racial language, but just, you know, if this kid w had been white, would you have said that your impressions been the same? So I said, you know what? I'm going to volunteer to, I'll write up all the reviews. I wrote this guy up, and I thought, this is why Black alumni have to get involved in the interviewing process, because some alumni are probably really not giving an unbiased review of these kids. You know, it is shaded by their race. And that made me committed to doing. And I always wanted to do them by myself. And, you know, so I could, you know, write up the review myself, because I just wanted an honest assessment. And it wasn't like I thought every, you know, Black student was phenomenal, but I thought I gave them a fair assessment. And there were a lot that were phenomenal, you know? And that's why I stopped, because I became And I know it's tough to get into Dartmouth, really tough to get into Dartmouth. But I just did not understand, based on the what Dartmouth was looking for, why some of these students didn't get in. So after, 20 plus years of doing it, I thought, I don't want to do this anymore, because I spent a lot of time, because as you can tell, I'm a talker, and I spend anywhere, usually at least 90 minutes to 2 hours talking to every student. So I think that I get a pretty good overview of who they are, whether or not, and I don't think Dartmouth is right for everyone. I really don't. I think it takes, Dartmouth is a horse of a different color. And I think, you get a feel for what students would thrive in that environment and what students would probably struggle. So it just became heartbreaking to a certain extent that, when certain people didn't get in. And I couldn't understand why. So I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. It's too tough emotionally, because you get invested in these kids. And I've had a lot of, because I spent a lot of time, and I always did with these young applicants, I think I get, I'm not doing a 15, 20, 30 minute interview. I'm really spending time with these students and talking to them. And I mean, I've had some really interesting, good conversations with students, particularly biracial students. They share a lot about, their dealings with that and their experiences with that. Because I think I'm easy to talk to, and I'm genuinely interested. So they usually open up and share a lot with me. So I think I can give them a really good assessment. Whereas, when you spend 15 minutes and you ask the usual questions, you're not getting a lot of insight in who that student is. So yeah, it became very frustrating. But for a long time, I did a lot, a lot for Dartmouth. And mainly because, one thing, I thought I had a very good experience there, and I would recommend Dartmouth. Again, not everybody's right for Dartmouth, but I think there are students who would really thrive there, and it would be a good experience. So yeah, so now I don't do a lot, if anything, anymore.
So, I would like to actually end this interview by asking why you're taking part in this project. And I think it's like quite relevant, since you just said you're not really as involved with Dartmouth as you used to be.
Well, because I think I had a unique experience there. I think I'm very involved in my own ancestral search and gaining information. And I think that the experiences of Black people on Dartmouth's campus should be in the archives. I think that, 100, 200 years, people will want to know about those experiences and what was it like, and especially being one of the first women to graduate, and being a Black woman who was in that class. I just think it's important for our voices to be heard and our experiences. And that's one of the things that I mentioned to you earlier about, because the seven women, outside of the three of us, the other four women, three had come from HBCUs, and four came from sister schools, Ivy League schools. The journey was, very different. And my perspective could be very different from Wanda's versus Brenda's, or
Wanda Johnson.
I think she came from Stevens College somewhere in the Midwest. I think she was from Tennessee. Four of us were from the South, and three were from the North. Leslie was New York, Upper New York. Terry was Midwest. I'm not sure where Lorna was from, but somewhere
Just from
north.
New Jersey.
Yeah. But our journeys were just so unique and different. And especially for the three that had no relationship or knowledge of Dartmouth before they came, had never stepped foot on the campus. Their journey was experience was probably very different. It's not something we ever really talked about. Just not of interest, I suppose, to us at the time. But now, that I thought about it, I thought, oh, wow, probably be very, very different. But I like the idea, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to give the poster to the am was because, hey, black women were here. And we were active on campus and involved. And I also sent one to the archives. Just so it didn't get lost in history. If you want your history written the way you want it written, you have to do it yourself. So I am thrilled about the project and to have this history documented in the archives.
We're really thrilled to have your voice reflected in the archives as well, because we think it's a really important addition.
Yeah, and I love Darby. And I had a great experience. So, despite, the time and place, it's important to know that a black woman came there and, thrived from it. It was a benefit, and I hope I've contributed something, back to the college in turn. I spent many hours on Dartmouth's behalf. So I think I've earned my keep. So I appreciate it. Thanks so much for reaching out.
Thank you for accepting. I know that you weren't like 100%, like feeling 100%. So thank you for like finding the time and strength to do this.
Well, I really, as I said, I really wanted to do it. And I do think that the work that you're doing and your colleagues are doing is very important to get our history in the archives so that we are not forgotten people and in a place where it's easily acceptable. I've dealt along many for many years with archives. And in fact, I have some stuff from one of the former presidents who's now deceased of BATA, he gave me years ago that I didn't some of it I sent to the archives and unfortunately I came across some additional stuff that I had tucked away that I need to send to the archives. So I'm definitely on board with regard to and supportive of documenting the history of Blacks on campus and the work that's been done about was it Woody Lee who did the thing? Yeah, that was just outstanding, the work that he's done. And at one point I had tried to do some research on the slaves that were brought to Dartmouth, but I ran into a dead end because I was very interested in trying to find out some information. I found some a little information, but the when I was doing it, and there may be more resources available, someone to have more success with doing it. But I've been documenting my family ancestry, oh gosh, for over 20 years now. And I've learned a lot, learned a whole lot, that, you know, I'm glad to know, because, you know, my journey, my family's journey in America goes back much further than I knew, and found out that some of my ancestors were likely brought over in the among the first wave of Africans brought over, and it goes back to the 1600s. You know, it's nice to know. Yeah, it's like go back to where you came from. You know, what are you? You know, your family's been here 25 years, 50 years. Well, how about 300 years, 400 years? You know, so it's been eye opening for me to have that information and to be able to see how my southern male ancestors here in the South registered to vote during Reconstruction, and how dangerous that was for them, and how brave it was for them. Many of them could not write, so you know, you have their X and then somebody wrote in their name. But even though they might not have been able to read or write, they wanted to take advantage of the right to vote. And, you know, knowing what happened after Reconstruction, after the North moved its troops out of the South, they lost that. But when people forget about that period of time when Blacks were allowed, well, you had to meet certain criteria, obviously, but if you met that criteria for a brief time during Reconstruction, they were able to vote. So the right to vote was here and then disappeared for a very, very long time. But that's incredibly moving to know.
I'll do a bit of digging around and see if I can point you in the resources, in the direction of any resources on slavery at Dartmouth, because there has been like some recent like advancements.
Yeah, there was something written many years ago that it had the names of the slaves. I worked through ancestry.com, and so I went in and tried to research on them to see. But I could find, you know, very little. I mean, there was some interesting information there, but they sort of disappeared, you know, and that's what happened with a lot of Black folks, you know, even my relatives, you know, they're there and then they're not on the census for a while and then they come back, you know. I haven't done anything on that for probably maybe, was that 10 years ago? So there may be more information that was available, but I don't think I was really aware of that. Certainly not when I was there, you know, none of us were thinking about that. And I don't think that was ever documented anywhere initially. But I did find, oh gosh, who was it? Was it Carter that came to campus and he wrote a letter to the professor and his wife, thanking them for their hospitality. And he was sending him, I think it was Carver, because he said he was sending them some sweet potatoes.
Right.
And that was really interesting. But I will let you go. Thank you so much for letting me go on and on and on.
But no, thanks for the additional information. I'm gonna stop the recording now.
Okay.